From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Back when George Saunders was a geophysics graduate with dreams of being a writer, the faculty at Syracuse University's creative writing program decided to take a risk on him. They called him their grand experiment, and today George Saunders has multiple awards and a MacArthur Genius Grant to his credit, along with a lavishly praised new collection of short stories called 10th of December, which the New York Times called the best book you'll read this year. We'll talk with George Saunders about his life and work and the crafting of the short story. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our Forum program. George Saunders joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award, an author of such volumes of short stories as Pastoralia and Civil War Land and Bad Decline. He recently published his fourth book of short stories, his first in 6 years, and it's called 10th of December, a work praised highly by acclaimed literary figures such as Dave Eggers, Jennifer Egan, Jonathan Franzen, Zadie Smith, and the mysterious and nearly never cited Thomas Bintion. A contributor to The New Yorker, George Saunders teaches in the creative writing program at Syracuse University and has been there for 16 years, and he's with us this morning on Forum, and so good to have you here.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
I must say, just for listeners, that George and I met once before with one of his mentors and teachers, Tobias Wolff, when I was emceeing a Bay Area Barbary Coast Award that Toby Wolff was a recipient of. And I found George, as many people have said, a very modest and humble and generous-spirited man. But now we're reading the kind of praise that one doesn't get in too many lifetimes. I mean, New York Times said, this is the best book of the year. It came out the first week in January. The best book of the year. Chicago Tribune said, best short story writer in America. I mean, what does this do to you?
Well, I'm lucky that I'm old. So, it's kind of like, I was thinking it's a little bit like when you're walking down the street and someone's cooking in a house and it smells really wonderful. You know, you're dumb to mistake that for your food, but you'd also be kind of silly not to linger on the sidewalk a little bit. So far, so good.
Well, actually, that metaphor of the food reminded me of how you described the short story. Maybe we can get right into it. I think you were talking about it with Colbert, in fact, about how you compared it to love. I think is what you did.
Yeah,
right? A long trip with a novel and a short love trip with the.
Yeah, because one of this book has sort of stirred up this, I think, kind of artificial controversy about short story versus novel. So he was kind of saying, well, the novel is obviously superior because it's so huge. And I just said that for me, the novel is like if you were in love with somebody and you had the chance to tell them, but you got to take a week-long train trip and you could, there'd be boring times and exciting times. And the story is more you're on the platform and she's getting on the train and you've got 2 minutes, you know. So to me, it's a harder form and potentially a lot more gorgeous because of the time constraint and the kind of, you know, the compression.
Well, Colbert notwithstanding, it is an ongoing controversy. We've actually done a program on it. The idea that writers get concerned about, can I really sell short stories? A novel, you know, mm-hmm. I might be able to sell easier and the marketplace and all that.
Yeah. Well, I you know, it's funny. If we had talked in October, I would have said, yeah, I know. And I was thinking, you know, I always had a pretty small but dedicated audience. And I thought, well, maybe it's me. Maybe there's some kind of MFA tick that I have that's purposely excluding people. So I kind of made a note to self that after this book came out, I was going to really think about that. Maybe write a novel, maybe just kind of retool a little bit and see if I could attract more readers by some adjustment, some aesthetic adjustment. So now I'm confused because this one's...
I'm sorry for your confusion, George.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Everybody should have such confusion. Right. I mean, you've really arrived, and congratulations. This book has gotten an enormous amount of attention, and deservedly so. I mean, you're what I describe, often characterize as an original storyteller. I mean, people will see your pedigree goes back to writers. Zadie Smith compared you to Twain, but, you know, I see you as coming out of, a sort of more contemporary zeitgeist writers like Barthelmay and Coover and experimental writers, they were called at one time. But you still have a realistic vein in your work. It's big.
I think part of it was I had a kind of I came to it from a strange angle because I was an engineering guy. I went to the School of Mines in Colorado, and first job was in the oil fields in Asia. So I had kind of a, I was a big reader, but a kind of strange reader. I read Hemingway and back. Nobody knew. And then, Steinbeck was a big hero. So my understanding of fiction as a 22-year-old was that it was supposed to be emotionally powerful, that period. And but in that, I also liked Khalil Gibran and I liked Robert Persig. And so then when I got a little further along in life and life got more complicated, I think I arrived at the place where I thought, well, the conventional realist means, in my hands anyway, are insufficient to express the confusing, beautiful thing that I'm seeing. And that's when Bartholomew showed up and that's when Vonnegut showed up. And I something kind of clicked where I thought, oh, this is not unemotional writing. This is just writing that's attempting to access emotion by any means necessary. And maybe in our time, or maybe in any time, to really channel life, you might have to push it up into kind of a supernatural or science fiction vein, you know.
Well, which is what you've done. Yeah. In fact, I was thinking about the fact that David Foster Wallace, who was on the program with me a number of years ago, and we took a cut from it when we had D.T. Max, who did this biography of him. Mm. And in that conversation we had, the cut was all about the difference between sentimentality and emotion and how you mine for emotion. I mean, as a guy who has an engineering and geophysicist background, that's a conversation, in fact, you had with Wallace, wasn't it, about mining for emotion?
Yeah, and I think just the idea that it had to be earned and that there were so many cheap off-ramps, you know, that especially a person who, for whatever psychological reason, is a people pleaser, which I certainly am. And I think in some ways, even Dave was, although he didn't seem that way at first. So there's lots of ways that you can take these sort of cheesy off-ramps to emotion, which is that's sentimentality. So I think that for me, the trick was to kind of be in touch with the part of me that had been really confused by life and dazzled by it, and then say how let's remember that the story is not a mirror. It's a machine. It's a strange aesthetic machine that you have to design to produce effect. And you might not as the artist, you might not even be sure of the relation between your work and real life. That maybe is too controlling to be too sure of it. So it's kind of interesting. For me, it's more and more. It's intuitive. There's a lot of intuition. There's a lot of iteration, and not a whole lot of theorizing before or after, which is kind of, it leaves you in a strange position when you're talking about your work, because 90% of it seems to me is just in micro decisions that you make as you're revising, you know. So,
George Saunders is our guest this hour, and his book is December 10th. And I should mention, just for the sake of those of you who are listening who may not know a lot about George Saunders, perhaps some of his humility comes out of his work experience. He was a delivery boy, he was a doorman, he was a convenience store clerk, as well as a technical writer and a roofer, and did geological work, as he said earlier, which I guess was at Radon where you learned a lot about writing and writing skills. Yeah,
I learned a lot because it was kind of the job. If you'd asked me at 18, what's the job you will not take, that it was it, because it was a corporate job, but not a glamorous corporation, small local provincial office of this engineering environmental company. And so it just, we'd had our daughters, so it was kind of a necessity. And so I kind of despaired. I thought, well, I'm never going to get material here at work. But then, of course, you know, literature is everywhere. And after about a year, I thought, wait a minute, there's something, you know, there's human beings here and they're living and they're loving and they're being disappointed. And that's that, and the corporate language starts to
you
seep
learned
into
corporate
the,
talk.
Yeah, I learned it because we were just immersed in it. And in fact, we had to sort of do it, you know. And so there's something intriguing about that. Like, well, maybe poetry is any diction that you overflow is poetic. So when somebody at Radian was trying to, get somebody fired, for example, or plead for their job in a memo, there are certain constraints that they were very aware of, and yet you couldn't help but feel the emotion kind of coming through. And that was kind of an interesting breakthrough. You know, I would be working on a tech document on one screen, and then when somebody would leave the room, I'd hit Shift F3 and work on a story. So you couldn't help but sort of carry some of the revision habits and the kind of the minimalism of a tech report into the story, you know. So it was kind of a joyful thing to see that art won't be denied if you're really interested in it. If there's one other human being in the room, there's got to be a story in there somewhere. So it was a great inadvertent lesson.
The story is where you put your emphasis. I mean, story and language and plot. I mentioned Pynchon before as someone who's given you a nice blurb on this book. And people often talk about Pynchon's characters as being kind of almost cartoonish or, you know, more flat, to use Ian Forrester's word. You're more interested in the story than the character, aren't you?
I don't make the distinction, because when I do, there's something reductive in me that kicks in and the story gets worse. So I tend to think of it as, I was being edited by Bill Buford at The New Yorker one time. It was a story called Sea Oak that was in an earlier book. And we were kind of in a hurry, and he was suggesting some pretty big cuts. And so I did what any person would do. I went fishing for a compliment. You're like, Bill, what do you like about this story? And he said this really profound kind of a Zen thing. He said, and he was a very slow talker. He was very comfortable with silence. And he said, what I like about it? I read a sentence and I like it enough to go on to the next. And then I waited, and that was the entire philosophy. And I thought that's a kind of an amazing, since the story is a linear temporal process, everything that comes out of it, theme, politics, meaning, all character, it all has to come out a sentence at a time. So from a creator standpoint, that was a really nice way for me to, nice simple way for me to come at it.
So you just go from sentence to sentence and just move it forward in a linear way.
Yeah. And of course, but also for me, iteratively, so that's over hundreds of drafts and kind of reading it at speed and trying to, and this is the hard part, trying to see how am I actually reacting to my own prose? How would a first-time reader react to it? And not to necessarily articulate that, but sort of almost like playing tennis, it comes at you, that was out of bounds, I got to turn slightly to the left. So as I'm revising, I'm just thinking, honestly now, if you hadn't read this a million times before, where would you be right now? And it's almost like there's a little meter in your head. Positive is over here. You want to keep the needle in that zone. And when it deflects, then all you really know is that revision is required to taste.
You literally do 100 revisions?
There's a story in this book that I started in 98, and I have...
Is it the diary story?
Yeah. And I have boxes of, and I don't really know what a revision, what comprises a revision, but I have boxes. I went through at one point, threw away every other box because there were too many boxes.
The Semplica Girl Diaries. Let's talk about that story a bit, because there's themes that emerge in it. It's like, it's a guy, who gets some money to get back solvent and a scratch off, and he's had his troubles, and he looks to people who have more, and kind of like average Schlemiel in many ways. Mm-hmm. I think trying to get through life, loves his daughters and wants the best for them, and then we have this futuristic vision which involves essentially illegal immigrants, undocumented, whatever you want to call them, sort of strung up literally in a technological way, but they're for the purpose of entertainment alone. Right. I mean, this is a pretty strong political statement.
Yeah. Well, that's, I dreamed that story. In 98, I had this actually quite beautiful dream where I got up out of bed and went to this non-existent window, and in our yard were four kind of beautiful young women that I understood to be sort of third world, just in some vague sense, all in these white smocks and long black hair. And they were on this kind of apparatus that looked like a swing set, except the top bar was a thin wire, and it ran right through their temples, in and out, in and out, in and out. And but the part of the dream that was so interesting and weird was that in the dream, the person I was wasn't horrified, but I felt like, oh, finally we've arrived. I'm so lucky, And that was an emotion I was feeling a lot in real life, because our kids were well and happy and we were doing okay. But it was just a strange transference. And I woke up from that. I thought, man, what the heck does that mean? And it meant, on one level, it meant something sort of obvious. We oppress the third world. So then it took me 12 years to figure out the other things that it meant. And
really find the emotion that you had felt from the dream.
Well, that, and also to find another, because my thing is if you achieve what you set out to achieve, you basically failed in a short story. That there's that Einstein quote about no worthy problem is ever solved in the plane of its own conception. So my early failings in the stories were that I knew just what I wanted you to feel, and I dump it on you, and how you doing? Did you feel it or not? And so my work got interesting to me when I would go in and not really have any idea of where it was supposed to go. So in that one, I kind of, after the dream, I kind of knew too well what it was, quote unquote, about. And the 12 years were to try to complicate it and add something to the emotion. You know, that was the primary emotion of the story. But then as you're writing, you find out, oh, it's also about this. It's also about this.
Did you ever have a dream before like that? I think Robert Louis Stevenson dreamed Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But is this the only story?
No, I've had about five, and they were all weirdly important stories in my growth. Just almost like your subconscious is sort of like, ah, come on. All right, here, have this clue, you know. So I've had, I think five. And, of course, 300 that were, you know, penguins playing the cello, and then you discard those. But there's a certain flavor in those five where I woke up and I thought, oh, that's... And you know, the flavor is, I don't get that. You know, I that's interesting, but I don't understand that. What am I supposed to do with that? And then the subconscious, kind of like Yoda, says, figure it out, you will.
Yeah, I have a friend who says that's cheating. You're taking unconscious as far as your creativity is concerned and making it conscious. Mm-hmm. But there's another story in this particular selection called Escape from Spiderhead, mm-hmm. which has very dreamlike qualities to it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a surreal quality I find in your work. And these are essentially guinea pig-type criminals who are going through experiments getting, and it may be plausible, again, in a futuristic sense, having intense love sort of injected into them and then having it taken out of them and then being made to choose whether or not they want the person that they were so in love with to suffer. Mm. I mean, it's an allegory, really. Mm. I mean, it's about the vagaries of love, as I read it.
Yeah. Well, I also, ever since I was a kid, I had a really bad flu one time. And I just was struck by how grouchy I was. Like, everything was yucky. Everything in the house had a kind of taint about it, you know. And none of my friendships were any good. And then, the flu passed and everything went back. But I never forgot that feeling of that what I would have called my character or myself was totally mutable. And it was just a little virus that did it, you know. And mm-hmm. and life did not seem at all good during that time. Or I remember once I was working in Asia and I got sick on the way home. I'd gone swimming in a river that was polluted with monkey poop, actually. But, and so I got really sick. And I remember flying near Hawaii and being in the bathroom thinking, I wish, please, Lord, let this plane crash because I can't take any more of this, you know. So, but then, you know, the next day or whatever, you feel good and life is back on its feet. So that's an interesting idea to me that we are, at least at one level, chemical beings. And, you know, as in Dickens, you know, a bit of undigested beef can make us see ghosts and everything. So that was the start of that story. And then the other thing that there's a part where they give him a drug that makes him more articulate. And that hit home for me because a lot of times...
It's all his poetry, in fact.
Right. Yeah. He suddenly is very, very, very articulate. And but that really, you know, sometimes stories, they come out of your own desire to do something different. So I can't remember what it was, but I'd written a story before that where I'd sort of suppressed the language in a kind of a minimalist way and did a lot of drafts. And so I was just tired of that. I was tired of dumbing the voice down. And I kind of started to do it again in the beginning of that story. And I thought, I need some way to get into a higher register. And because I already had the idea of there being drugs, I thought, he could have a drug where he can speak the way I want to speak now. And then, you know, that came. So it's kind of an interesting
process. It's also plausible within the grand scheme of things.
Sure.
A lot of your stories are really dark, though. I'm sure you're aware of that. And, you know, I read that you actually worked in the Sumatra jungles. I mean, you've had some experiences that probably lend themselves to whatever your vision may be. But particularly, I remember reading in GQ years ago, a piece you did close to home here in Fresno, and the homeless people. You were with them, in fact.
Yeah, I went for a week incognito in the tent city that they had there.
Have seminal experiences?
Generally? Yes, seminal. But also, strangely, you know, I've had the experience of, I did a piece in Dubai. That was the first piece I did for GQ. And, you know, you talk about the haves and the have-nots and the whole thing. But I was always already working on that Semple Girl story. Went to Dubai and thought, oh, my God, this is it. It's, you know, it's actually happening. But, you know, the darkness thing is, I always feel like if you, you know, if you look at real life, there's no limit to the darkness. I mean, you could go in and select somebody and whose life is so beyond narration, it's so dark that no one would bear it, you know. And on the other end of the spectrum, there's people who just glide through life in this kind of heaven realm. You know, everything goes well for them. They're beautiful and they're fortunate. So I've begun to think that fiction, I think to work, it has to exist in a kind of middle zone where both darkness and, say, lightness are represented, where if you want to call it a battle between them, or maybe between good and evil, that battle has to be sort of viable.
So Manichaean battle.
Yeah, it can't be too far off. You know, if you wrote a story about a person who couldn't possibly win, I don't think you could get any traction. And conversely, if you wrote a story about someone who always won, that doesn't get any traction. So I think each writer has to probably operate in some kind of realm where mystery and drama are possible. But for me, this is, I don't understand this, but I always have to go a little dark to get any traction. You know, Flannery O'Connor said a writer can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. And for some reason, I skew dark. So,
well, you remind me, since you're quoting Flannery O'Connor, of a quote of Bertolt Brecht's, the man who laughs has not yet been told the terrible news. But your stories are funny, though. I mean, so are hers, for
right,
that matter.
Right.
I mean, they're dark, but they're still, you know, they used to call it black humor or gallows humor,
yeah,
or whatever. And there's tenderness. And
I think that's where if you go on the theory that it should have a negative and a positive valence just to sort of be a workable scale model, then the negative is the events. But the positive is the humor, or the kind of, maybe the joy of the telling, or something like that. So that to me makes sense. And I think most stories, you know, are pretty dark. They're kind of on the day when things change, and often on the day when things change for the worse.
It's hard to write happy.
And I think that Motherland or somebody said that happiness writes white, and it's really true. And that's one thing, as I'm getting older, I'm desperately trying to figure out how to do that a little more, because it's technically very hard.
But one of your earlier stories, which I love, called The Flamboyant Grandson, is a story that just lifts you and elevates you. I remember, in fact, Raymond Carver wrote, as I'm sure you know the story, Cathedral sent it to Tobias Wolfe, and Tobias Wolfe said he felt like he was levitating coming off of the couch.
I didn't know that story. That's
but
beautiful.
I feel a little bit that way with that story, Flamboyant Grandson. It's about a kid who is just very different, maybe even different in the way of his expressing his gender or his androgyny or whatever you want to call it. And it just feels so good at the end of that story.
Yeah, you know? It's funny, you know, and what surprised me in that story was that it's narrated by his grandfather. And there's a moment where the grandfather turns to him and basically says, I love this person no matter what, and I will stand up for him. And it's always, I find it always thrilling when in a work of art, somebody says a thing that we all think every day, you know, which is, I love you, I will stand up for you. But to see it, I think about the movie Bicycle Thieves, you know, that scene where the father takes the son out for pizza. That gets me every time. So I think it's hard. It takes a certain confidence maybe and a certain experience of the world to get over maybe your young person fear of being sentimental or sappy or, you know. And so often I think we cloak this stuff in irony.
That story does it for me. I mean, and like the Bicycle Thief for you, but it's also a dark story in many ways. I mean, you know, it's an Orwellian world that you present, very much so. I'm talking to Gavin Newsom in the last hour about technology and everything. It's technology ruling our lives is what that story is.
But we have a tool. You know, we can fight back.
Well said. And we're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with author George Saunders, who has a new collection of stories out called 10th of December, a work that has been highly praised and a work that really needs to be read. Let me invite you to join this conversation. You may be a fan of George Saunders. You may want to talk to us about literature, which is, of course, what we're talking about, writing and the creative process. He's taught creative writing for 16 years. We'll talk a little bit maybe about teaching creative writing. And also should mention the fact here that stories and novels, there is a difference. They're not just heftier, like Colbert said. You may want to weigh in on that as well. Weigh in on what's not necessarily heftier, but what engages you more, or the genre. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your call, so please feel free to join the conversation. 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our handle is @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with fiction writer George Saunders, who has, as I said earlier, certainly arrived in the world of letters and has a new book out December 10th and is spending this hour with us, and certainly welcome your calls and your involvement in the conversation. We should also mention that George Saunders is a teacher of creative writing and has been teaching at Syracuse University, which has had such notables as Raymond Carver and Toni Morrison and David Foster Wallace, And you taught Cheryl Strait, in fact, didn't you?
I didn't teach her much, but she was ready when she came. She was really wonderful. Yeah.
Let me tell you how you can join the program again. Toll free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. A few of your emails first. Here's Red, who says, when you've done 104 revisions, how do you know the 105th is the right one? Other than a deadline, what tells you the story's ready?
I don't have any deadlines, so it's kind of me and my neuroses. I've often thought it's a little bit like painting. If you had to paint a floor of a room, you know, you paint it, and you're getting closer to the door, and then you see a spot over here that needs a touch-up, and then you decide to change the whole color. But at some point, you're there, and you're pretty satisfied with what's behind you, and you've got one footprint left, you know, and you hit it. And then at that point, usually when I think I'm done, I'll wait a couple days, read it again. And at some point, I give it to my wife. And we've been together for 26 years, and she was also a student of Toby's at Syracuse. So, and she reads it with a real a heart, you know, and so she'll say, yeah, this is good enough to send out, or it isn't.
So she's your ultimate editor, maybe, huh?
Well, she's the first editor, and then and she's really the one who tells me whether it's got sort of
heart.
That's, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And if it doesn't, I believe her. She wouldn't lie to me. And then of course there's usually a couple of days where I'm like, oh, why did I even ask her? You know. But then I know she's right. And then I send it to the New Yorker, and Deborah Treisman is an incredible line editor, and we kind of tend to shrink wrap the pieces a little, so she'll cut just sometimes hundreds of words, maybe even more. Sometimes in the title story, it was sent to her at 13,000, and we cut it together down to 9. So she's a great friend in that way, and great eye. And
this is what great editors do. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about, of course, Maxwell Perkins. You know, you get these tomes of Thomas Wolfe's that were thousands of pages, literally, yeah. And just have to cut it down. Let me bring a caller into this conversation. That's Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Morning, Paul.
Hi. Hey, I'm a big fan. I've been running to this as a book on tape, which is pretty magical. But my question is, one of my favorite things about it is the fact that you are reading your own story, so I'm getting it literally from the source. And I'm curious as to what does that process look like in terms of making the decision as to whether you're going to do your own narration or pass it off to someone else to interpret.
Yeah. Well, this was actually the first book that I've ever had out on audiobook at all. So I think I'm pretty sure that Random House made the decision to let me have a shot at it. And I was really happy to do that because I love, you know, doing readings and stuff like that. And so this was my first experience. And it was, I think about, it takes an incredible amount of time. I was like 4 or 5 days in the studio of trying to read. And one of the only real technical problem was I had a gurgly stomach, and these microphones were really sensitive.
What is with you and a gurgly stomach? I think you came in with one.
Yeah,
this morning,
I pretty much just carry it around everywhere I go. Just it's a Faustian bargain.
because of the food you eat?
Yeah, the tacos in the morning.
Tacos in the morning. What kind of tacos?
I know.
Chicken tacos?
Chicken, whatever I can get.
So who was it that had to have tacos all the time? It'll come to me. Somebody in the entertainment world, you know, wherever he, I mean, listeners can help me. Can't connect it right now. So we'll connect to another caller, and that's Dan. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Dan.
Yeah, I have a question for you, George. A friend of mine, Jim Raines, was working at a bookstore, and he turned me on to your book that had the story about the people living in the theme park.
Yeah.
And that's just was such an ingenious, I don't know what you call it, plot device or just original idea. I was just wondering how you came up with that. And secondly, have any of your stories been optioned for film?
Yeah, you know, the first one I had when I was younger, I had this Hemingway fixation that I just loved his work, and I couldn't, you know, when you're imitating somebody, you see the world in his eyes. And at some point, it started to wear out, and I kind of couldn't get rid of it. And I had actually a dream of a theme park, and it was this weird dream where I was the attendant of this room, and in the room, the shtick was that gravity was suspended. So I was watching these people come into this room where gravity was suspended, and the dream came with kind of addiction. Like I woke up, and I could narrate the first 4 or 5 lines. And so really, that whole theme park thing was just a trick that I would play on myself to kind of disrupt this Hemingway realist tendency. So if you're using, you know, Hemingway-esque diction, but you put it in the Virgin Mary theme park, suddenly you've kind of upped the ante a little bit. So that just became, especially in the first couple books, kind of a, you know, just a self-maintenance trick to make sure that I didn't revert back to this kind of realism that I could never pull off.
You were really trying to write like Hemingway then.
Oh, very much. Yeah. I'd been in Asia, and so I have whole, folders of very Hemingway-esque narrations of Asia. But then, that magical moment happens where, as you get older, you get frustrated with the failure of his language to describe your world. So I was living in Amarillo and...
Or you find your own language, don't you?
And I think that's why, yeah. Because you're so sick of the reductive effects of imitation and the things that you have to exclude from your own experience, which in my case, they were always things that seemed a little pathetic compared to Hemingway has sort of this glamorous international life. And I was, living in Amarillo, working at an apartment complex. And so you'd have a day and you'd have some kind of emotional experience that seemed real, turn to write about it and find that you didn't have the proper diction because you were a slave to this other writer. So I think that's something all young writers go through.
And so many with Hemingway. Although there he was, this international celebrated figure, on the world stage and the iconic, maybe one of the great American icons other than Marilyn Monroe and Elvis, but a very tortured man. And, a man who was constantly eating himself up inside and constantly needing to prove himself.
There was a great essay by Hunter S. Thompson, and I don't think he was right about this, but his theory was that one of the reasons Hemingway killed himself was that his diction and his sort of the choices he'd made to become such a great stylist, the choices of exclusion and so on, were not serving him well as the late 50s and early 60s came. And America was changing so fast that his diction couldn't fit. I think actually he was just clinically depressed.
But, he was clinically depressed, but also a lot of his creativity had dried up, and probably, he was a little bit like Jake Barnes in the libido or the sexual performance area, too, from what we know. Going, by Hotchner and Carlos Baker and all these people who have written about Hemingway. But that last caller talked about the ingenious nature. You hear the word genius a lot, mainly in part because...
Not around my house.
Well, not around your house. No, you never hear that at home. But the MacArthur grant and, it's a genius grant and everything. Mm-hmm. Again, you come across as a very self-possessed and in many ways humble man. Does it have any effect when you keep hearing the word genius?
No, because I know there are geniuses, and I know for a fact that I'm not. I mean, I'm a really hard worker, and I think what I have is that because of my life and maybe because of my neurology, I come at it from a strange angle. So the combination of the kind of handicap of the weird education and background plus the hard work produces something that's kind of different. But, you think about people like Dylan, or Chekhov, these are people, or Picasso, people who are just fluid and they're just unobstructed. And that is not, that's not a description of me. So I'm a pretty good hard worker. And I've got the nice Catholic virtue of I've an inner nun who won't let me send something out until it's ready. But that's a big difference between that.
Were they hitting your knuckles and doing that?
No,
sort of thing?
No, not so much that.
Again, our guest is George Saunders. And by the way, if you'd like to join us, you can do that by phone at 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. Here's an email that says, "Mr. Saunders was an engineer before he became a full-time writer. I was wondering if he could talk about how he transitioned into writing." Well, you intimated some of that, but any advice for others trying to pursue that path?
Yeah. Well, the one thing that I learned under pressure was that you don't need 6 hours a day to write a book. And I wrote my first book at the job, kind of stealing time. And it was, that old thing about the knowledge that one is to be hung in the morning has the effect of focusing the mind. So we had our kids, and it was clear that I wasn't going to get 4-hour stretches. They were never going to happen. So then suddenly, that kind of cliche.
Excuse me, did you, because we were talking about Carver before, he resented his kids because he didn't have the time. He didn't feel
anything. No, not at all. It was quite the opposite. It was kind of like we had our kids and I kind of woke up to the world like, wow, this could have gone otherwise. And then the thing I knew about myself is I would not be a good starving artist. My work would suffer if I was causing the family to suffer. So I thought, all right, let's just buck up here, get a sort of mid-range job at an engineering company. And then, there's a sort of permission giving where, because that was all I could do and because I felt it was basically an honorable decision, then if 15 minutes came my way, all that kind of nonsense that I used to have about how much time I needed, what circumstances, the quiet and all that, that all went away. And my mind said, okay, go ahead. Just do a paragraph, So that was, to me, that was a big eye-opener to think that if you just chiseled away for, and that first book took about 7 years, at
but
work.
You had to give yourself permission in a way, as
yes.
well as find the time.
Because I had a kind of working class prejudice that writing was done in a perfumed room while being fanned. You know,
jeez, I come from the working class. My notion was you did it with cockroaches and a
well, that's
in
the
a
second
garret.
Notion, right? Yeah. Right. But you know, the idea that somehow it was something, it was a precious thing. You had to be in a certain state of mind that only came rarely. And that job sort of knocked that out of you. You know, you think, well, okay, if that's the case, you're never going to do it. So do you want the 6 minutes or not?
This idea of struggling, though, I mean, in terms of bringing home the bacon and all that sort of thing. I mean, there was a line of yours I came across. You said, absence of wealth is an erosion of grace. Mm. That's a pretty profound line. Mm. But, I mean, and it comes across in the story we talked about, the diary story, for example.
Well, what I found was just, and again, we had a pretty beautiful time when our kids were little, but it was often, I missed being around them, and I was working at a job where I was a tech writer, so we had to sometimes stay really late, and, you know, and then also just that kind of, you know, for a writer, you don't have to have the full experience to have intimated to you, and then you can exaggerate it. So, for example, I'd come home at night tired, kind of over-caffeinated, and have 20 minutes with the kids, and you just have that feeling of not fully being there. You're not your cheerful self. You're not the guy you were at 8 o'clock when you left. You're a little beaten down, a little preoccupied, a little angry, you know. And our kids are so cute that they would charm it out of you. But just to know that as we talked about earlier, your physical, neurological state actually is character. So if you've been on your feet for 14 hours doing something that you really don't want to do, and drink too much coffee in order to do it, and then you have a long ride home, and you get there, you're not as gracious a character as you would be otherwise. Now, that's not the revelation, and we weren't in the gulag, but that was enough to kind of suddenly work was a political act. You know, you could understand how people in times past when they'd worked much harder had thrown off the yoke and so on. So.
How do you feel about teaching writing in general? I mean, I think you've said some things in the past about how it, you know, can be good for the inner life. It can be good as a nobility to learn the craft and study it and so forth. But a lot of young people go in. First of all, you wonder how I've always thought of teaching creative writing a little bit like teaching gymnastics. Some people have it and some people don't.
You know? True.
So you're dealing with people who, in some instances, have illusions about being a writer, the writing life, and it's a tough life. Very few people even make an income doing it.
Right. The only thing that we have going for us that sort of changes that, we're like an elite gymnastics school because this year we've got almost 600 applications for 6 spots. Mm-hmm. So by the time the top 70 are magnificent. And we have to cut that down to 6. So we're not even close to teaching them writing. They learn that.
You're like the Stegner program almost.
Very much. Yeah. So we, I think what we're doing is we're trying to take these already immensely talented people and challenge them to get into the zone of doing that which only they can do. When that's much more refined kind of psychological work. So if you took a bunch of high school kids and said, hey, you can all be writers, that's not very fair. And I think actually in our country, there's a little bit of a crisis because there's a double fallacy that I see a lot of young people who aspire to be writers buying into it. One, to be a writer, you have to be in an MFA program. It's false. Two, if you're in an MFA program, you'll be a published writer. False. So I think as long as people understand that those things are not true, although in the last 6 or 7 years, I've seen a rush to the door. People seem to be, undergrads seem to think, well, since I'm a writer, I now go right from undergrad to grad school, which I kind of don't recommend. I think a few years out in the world is, you know, better. Better for the writer.
Let's bring some more calls on. We'll go to Helen. Good morning.
Hello. I'm really happy to have by chance caught this show. And I wanted to ask Mr. Saunders, in light of the fact that there are 159 holds on your book at my local library here in Bolinas, while I'm waiting for the list to get down to me at 160.
It's almost every resident in Bolinas, I think.
Well, it's a kind of many library system. It's not just Bolinas here in Marin, but it's part of Marin. What books would you recommend that I read while I'm waiting for the big one to come my way?
I was going to say my other ones, but that seemed maybe a little.
I know. I looked at them in the library.
You can say that and be modest, or I could be your puppet here.
No, you know, I'll tell you a book that I read recently that kind of blew my mind was The Flame Alphabet by Ben Marcus. He's an incredibly great writer, and he just doesn't seem to be able to do anything traditional or lame. Everything's so energetic. And that book actually is physically upset me. It's so so edgy and so kind of dangerous. And then the other book I read recently that was amazing was Europeana by Patrick O'Rednick. And it's I don't even know why it's a novel. It's called an alternate history of the 20th century. And all he does is he just goes in and he just finds some strange facts that you didn't know and walks you through the 20th century with a slightly weird lens. And you come out of that and you really feel like the human animal is a total mystery, you know, even more than ever. And then the writer I just discovered through my daughter is a guy named Horacio Moya. I think he's a Salvadoran who's now living here, but he's got an incredible short novel called Senselessness that is, for me, is very inspiring because it's got all the the speed of a short story and the kind of narrative shape, but it's also got the kind of spread of a novel. So that was a really exciting find.
Well, Mr. Sayers, thank you for these suggestions, but I actually had in mind more your book.
Oh. Well, I would.
I didn't make that clear. I'm sorry.
No. I would say.
Let me give a recommendation here, because
sure.
I'm looking at an email, and this is David, who says, I never cried as much as when I finished reading your short story, The 400-Pound CEO, from the collection Civil War Land in Bad Decline. Reading your stories, I find myself feeling almost every emotion, sadness, happiness, anger, but above all, love for the complexity of humanity. Thanks for all the beauty.
Oh, thank you for that note. Yeah.
That's about as strong a recommendation, I think, as you can get, Helen.
David's actually my mother. She writes under David.
Oh, this is again, the title is Civil War Land in Bad Decline.
And, you know, a caller earlier asked about movies, and the title story from that book is one that I've been working on with Ben Stiller for about 12 years, and we're hoping that's the one. And then there's another, Escape from Spiderhead has been optioned by Condé Nast Films.
That seems like a natural for the world of sci-fi and all. Here's Ben, who writes, reading these stories makes me feel the way I did when I read Vonnegut for the first time. Listening to them being read is even better.
Oh, thank you. What a great show you've got going here. Let's keep
yeah. Hard work, but someone has to do it. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Jim. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi there. I just read 10th of December and just absolutely loved it. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I did have a question about you use hyperbole a bit to humorous effect. And there are a bunch of places where I thought it worked really well, and it seems a little over the top. The two that come to my mind are in the first story, the overprotective family, right?
Yeah.
Just, you know, I get it. It's the helicopter parents. It just seemed somehow it was a little too much. And I had a little bit the same reaction in the Semplica Diaries, not to the central premise, which maybe I won't give away, which I thought worked just fine. But the classmate, right, who's so enormously privileged, right, and there's the list of the house and the experiences they've had and all that, and it was all just spot on, but maybe dialed up just a little bit. And
yeah.
I wonder if you had any thoughts about obviously hyperbole is one technique of parody, right, or maybe of social commentary. But I wonder if you have any thoughts might be too much.
What you're calling hyperbole is something that borders more on satire or parody.
Right. Well, it's hyperbole is a technique of parody of satire. And I guess my question is, when does it... In both
you're asking George where the line is.
Maybe if it had been dialed back just a little bit, the satiric effect would have been maybe even a little stronger.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, for me, the whole deal is kind of like riding a bike. You know, you're going through it and... as you're rereading it for the 9 millionth time, you're just kind of trying to go a little left, a little right. So I guess it's kind of, your question is sort of theoretical, and I'm not sure I can. I mean, the only way I know how to answer that is through the revision. And to me, those felt right, but you know, it's every reader
as
for
a
himself.
Reader, they felt right to me. Yeah. I don't.
But I think, you know, your question is valid, because when you're, I would argue that all fiction has got it's all exaggerated. If you even describe a 3-minute incident, you're choosing, you're highlighting, you're omitting. And for me, there's a certain joy in what you're calling the hyperbolic. When I can take a human tendency and put some amphetamine and get it like 20% more, I take a lot of pleasure in that. But as you're suggesting, one of the things I'm learning is that there are places where if you tone it back, you might get more emotional effect. But all that stuff is sort of to taste as you're doing it.
Well, thank you for the call. We mentioned Flannery O'Connor before. She used to say, you know, they talk a lot about the grotesque in her work. She used to say it was like a child drawing, you know, when she would create some of these characters. And that can be seen as hyperbolic.
Right.
Catherine writes on our website, are you willing to describe where you write? What would I see in that space?
It's we live up in the Catskills, and we just when we bought the house, there was this old tool shed about 200 feet away from the house. So we just kind of revamped that, and so now the joke in our house is that I'm often the only tool in the tool shed. But it's just out of internet range, which is very nice. So it's a real simple. It's just a kind of a white box, really, with a a desk in it and as little distraction as possible.
You get a lot of kidding in the. Put downs from your estrogen-filled family.
No, we get a lot of correctives.
A lot of correctives. Oh, that's a good way to describe it. How old are your daughters now?
24 and 22.
And are they interested in writing?
Yeah, they're both good writers, and one is working in TV in L.A., and one is finishing up college in Chicago. So they're
what in TV?
She's an assistant, actually, and she's working on being a screenwriter.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking to George Saunders. And by the way, he will be speaking tonight at 6 p.m. at Book Passage in the Ferry Building. You can actually meet George Saunders there this evening. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. So for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller, and that's you, Neil. Hi.
Yeah, a couple of questions. First, speaking of Hemingway, have you ever read any George V. Higgins, and what did you think of him? Also, do you pay much attention to book critics? Do you remember the late Wilfred Sheed, who just died?
I don't, to my discredit, I don't know either of those names, but I do read the reviews, and I did a trip with Bill Clinton a couple of years ago for GQ, and I was asking him about criticism. How do you handle criticism? And he said this really interesting thing that I think had come to him from Hillary, which is that basically when somebody, throws a bunch of negative stuff at you, your human reaction is to flinch and, to deny and maybe even attack the person who's done. But she said, that's fine, but get over it. Because in that load of stuff that came at you, there might be a little bit of gold.
What's your opinion of Graham Greene?
He's great. He's great. What's your opinion of Graham Greene?
He is my favorite novelist in addition to John O'Hara, who's my other favorite novelist. Do you have an opinion of him?
He's a great novelist.
Any specific Graham Greene works?
The Ugly American? I don't know.
I'm
really not a scholar. I'm kind of... self-educated, so I've got big gaps in my reading, so I'm kind of the wrong person to ask.
Oh.
But Neil is a greenophile. Neil...
Definitely.
Yes. I don't mind my describing you that way. Well, calls in from time to time and always expresses his admiration of Graham Greene. Russ says, strange question. I'm a technical writer. Any advice on ways to become a better technical writer?
Well, I was always kind of a middling technical writer, so I... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, actually, honestly, it wasn't that different from creative writing in that the reader always appreciates it if you're being efficient and if you're respecting the reader's intelligence, they always appreciate it. So for me, that always meant cutting. Certainly in the tech writing, there was always an attempt to get it down as short as possible. And then that carried over to fiction. So if you think of reading and writing as kind of an intimate exchange, you'd want the person talking to you to be as efficient and thoughtful as possible. And I think that's true in tech writing, too.
You mentioned your background as a Catholic or growing up Catholic. How important was it in shaping your vision and really your writing habits and the stories you tell to have grown up in Chicago in the Midwest?
I think really, really important. We grew up on the South Side and went to Catholic schools. And I thought that the Catholic thing was huge because the beautiful symbology and rituals, and I had the thought that once that stuff gets in your head and once you get a taste of the beauty of that, you always have a space that needs filling. And I think when I get
for the aesthetics or the ritual or
everything for the I thought was wonderful was in the church at that time, well, Dorothy Day was a big presence. The idea that you would that action was related to spirituality, but also the way that the New Testament stories, especially, were always undertold, and the great truths underneath were not necessarily detailed for you, and the nuns assumed that you could get it. This transmission by storytelling was very respected. I remember, for example, we do the Stations of the Cross when we were kids. So you go in and there's images and you're instructed to look at the image of Christ's passion, then pray silently and also to visualize those things. So, and they would encourage us to visualize not only Jesus' experience, but also what's the Roman guard thinking, you know, what does Mary feel at this point? So for a young would-be writer, that was an incredible thing because not only were you sort of given an outline, but you were encouraged to think empathetically about people that you might not normally.
So your imagination's ignited.
Yeah, very much so. And they gave you plenty of time to do it. And there was this beautiful mounting feeling as you got to the seventh or eighth or whatever it was of really immersing in that and kind of leaving your own stuff behind. And it was very, very powerful. So I think once you get a taste of that, and it was undeniably wonderful, then the rest of your life you're kind of looking for some
way to fill it again.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, that's very Hemingway, too. I mean, not only Chicago, but also, you know, always looking for what Catholicism gave him.
Right.
But art nada that art nada, you know, became
Exactly.
This, George, so good to have you with us.
It's such a pleasure.
Pleasure to have you, and I hope you'll be back. Good luck and ongoing success in your writing career. George Saunders, 10th of December. His books and short story collections include Pastoralia and Persuasion Nation, and he is an English professor at Syracuse University. And again, we'll be speaking tonight at Book Passage in the Ferry Building at 6 p.m. We're here with you Monday through Friday, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can always continue to communicate with us either by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment, or by going to our Facebook page. And we do indeed like to hear from you, and those are ways of letting us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or what you'd like to hear on Forum. You can also call our toll-free number, 415-553-3300. And tomorrow, we hope Dave Iverson will be with you if everything goes according to plans. I'll actually be doing a program with Dave a week from Friday, which marks 20 years of sitting in the seat in front of this microphone. That's the day, a week from tomorrow. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, with production assistance from Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks, senior editor Dan Zoll, executive producer Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.